Okay, so
I'm John Baker.
I work at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. I don't get out much, but so this is my title, overview of black hole mergers in regular relativity simulations. But I want to try to, hopefully make it relevant in some places here, so it's not really just going to focus on numerical relativity simulations, but my shadow title, which is what I'm always thinking about anyway, what is the role of space-based gravitational wave astronomy overall? So you can be thinking about that question while listening to everything else. And just to be clear, here is some of the, this is a figure from Jeremy Schnittman, some of the types of signals from black hole mergers that have been considered or looked for or seen. And I am not considering all of this. I'm just considering this right here, which is the idea of we're trying to see black hole mergers at the peak moment when they're happening, in the scale of, you know, no longer than 1 year, and possibly even much shorter than that. So, but there could be electromagnetic and gravitational wave signatures in there. So I'm going to consider both possibilities. And so here's my master slide with a bunch of questions on it here. Two potential avenues for trying to observe these things would be gravitational waves and electromagnetic observations, which we certainly expect that they're generating gravitational waves. We don't really know whether they're generating any kind of observable EM signatures. And we know how to simulate gravitational waves from these in a lot of detail, which is what I'll probably spend the biggest part of the talk talking on. But so we have a lot of large-scale questions that says, what kind of information do the gravitational waves carry about the system? What details can you learn about? What kind of gravitational wave, what kind of information in the gravitational waves in general? What kind of details can you learn about the binaries? So I think a lot of the stuff that I'll talk about, there's surely somebody that knows more than I do about it, and there's a lot of stuff that maybe everybody knows, but so I'm just putting it in here anyway, because maybe there's somebody that doesn't know something about any of these topics. So, or for any topic, there may be someone that doesn't know about it. Look at it that way. But bigger questions are, what does this tell, what can we learn from these about the broader astrophysical processes that we'd really like to learn about, rather than just, you know, that individual system? How do these gravitational waves fit into the broader enterprise of astronomy? Something I'm always wondering about, and something that I'd like to talk about here, and maybe we have some splinter groups about the, you know, what do we learn about astronomy from gravitational waves? And, you know, out of this you have questions about what kind of instrument you need for this. So you have questions about electromagnetic observations. Are there mechanisms that can power an electromagnetic signal? What information might be in these? Could these signals be distinguished from the diverse phenomena of the sky? And what kind of instruments would be good for that? And getting answers to these kind of things, some of these kind of things, you know, maybe all of these, depend on some numerical simulations that have ideas of what to expect. So gravitational waves from black hole, massive black hole mergers, summary slide here, basic slide. You get gravitational waves when you have rapid changes or motion of massive objects. Probably everybody does know that by now here. The gravitational waves, we measure them as tidal accelerations of objects, relative motion of two objects. And so this is a little figure of how the, you know, circle of objects would respond to gravitational waves. Not going to talk about the observation problem. But if you sort of generally think about, so we the general properties of a black hole merger, a huge amount of energy is released in a really short period of time. So the amount of energy is some, is there, does someone have like a pointer? I'll just point here. Oh, great. Some fraction of the total rest mass of the black hole is released, the total mass of the black hole is released in a matter of a short period of time. So this might be a few percent. So the typical numerical simulation for comparable mass binaries, it's a couple to 10% or something, depending.
Why is it so efficient?
Why is it so efficient? Well, this is a purely gravitational process, right? So it's the black holes, you know, this is It's an extremely violent interaction by the time you get two black holes spiraling into each other. And that motion is coupled to, you know, in GR, the motion is coupled to radiation, and that's just how much radiation. These black holes are moving at a significant fraction of the speed of light by the time they merge. So there's just a great deal of energy released. So you can compare, you know, the few percent of the mass is released in a short period of time, and that's kind of like your few percent of the mass was released, a few percent of the accreted material's mass forming the black hole was released in electromagnetic radiation over time, too. So, yeah, it's probably less, but a comparable amount in one merger quickly. So the time scale for this, now you can try to be more quantitative than I have. Maybe that'd be a good thing to do. But, you know, it's on the order of several hundred to several thousand seconds for a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole. So, depending on how you define your time scale. And then you can, at the peak, the luminosity, the total energy per second, is probably the greatest luminosity of anything, any astronomical event, up to on the order of 10 to the 56 Earths per second. 10 to the 23 solar luminosities, and thereby more energy than all of the stars and all the galaxies. It's pretty short, depending on the mass of the system. It, you know, for 10 to the 6 solar masses, this is minutes.
That's your
500.
Right. So this is really just the peak part. It's a pretty sharp peak. So, and then special things about gravitational radiation, as an astronomical messenger, is we measure amplitude and not power. And also, sources like black hole mergers are monolithically coherent, meaning all the gravitational waves come out in phase. So that means that the sensitivity falls off like 1 over the distance rather than 1 over the distance squared. I can't think of anything else that would actually work like that. But there are would be other gravitational wave sources, stochastic sources, where you don't have this property. It's not coherent anymore, and so it's more familiar like 1 over d squared. You add to that the sources are rare, and it's not too surprising that, you know, your sort of entry-level instrument can see black hole mergers through the whole universe. Another thing about the black hole mergers, because the gravitational waves are weakly coupled to everything, they propagate cleanly without any kind of dispersion effects or obscuration being really likely. There is weak gravitational lensing. And you get information about masses and spins of black holes that can be quite precise. You also get, I was going to add on there, you get information about, you know, the distance and the sky position and stuff as well, but that's not as precise. In fact, pretty horrible in terms of sky position by a lot of standards. So we'd like to answer big questions like, how did the first massive black holes assemble, and how did their masses and spins evolve over time, and what's the relationship between black holes their galaxies, and what can we understand about the nature of black holes themselves and the nature of strong gravitational physics? These are big questions. We should talk about them a lot. Not so much something I get to say a lot about here, though hopefully at the end maybe we can return to these questions. But we do need, in order to, so there's also other things that, other than making gravitational wave observations, we can also learn from numerical simulations about
kicks and things like kicks
and the formation properties of merged black holes and also the potential for electromagnetic signatures. So here's a waveform, a simulated LISA observation from the original LISA, and it's got some noise, instrumental noise, and foreground astrophysical noise in there. It can be pretty clear. This is 2 10 to the 5 solar mass black holes at a ratio to 5. But so there's a long in-spiral approach, but then this is the part of the signal that you would use numerical relativity for just at the end. And this is on the order of a few thousand seconds here. You can see the peak part right here, Rich, is just well under 1,000 seconds. So we can also look at this. So this is the part. You're getting this signal, we didn't always know exactly what these signals look like, and it was a mystery until about a little less than 10 years ago when we first started being able to do the calculations. Sorry? That is the strain in, I don't even remember exactly what the units are on this, so. The strain, if you want, the strain is, if it's strain in the usual sense, then it's the amount of displacement of your little test particles in your detector per unit length. So that's what strain means. Sorry, I answered the wrong question. But so this is a similar thing. This is, again, old LISA, but this is in a frequency domain. So there's signal over a long period of time. These triangles represent where you are sort of up to 1 month. And so the signal can be observable for a year. There can be a significant amount of power well in advance of the merger. But this numerical simulation part is really where a lot of the power is for many of the sources, unless it's a really high mass running off the edge of the sensitivity window. All right, so in order to do that, we need to understand general relativity. So this is my slide that I include in my middle school presentations. It's general relativity in 1 minute. In special relativity, we took the concept of space and time and invented space-time in order to see how the speed of light can be constant. In general relativity, we add that space-time can be curved and that this replaces the concept of the gravitational field, and space-time is now dynamic, and mass and energy cause space-time to be curved, and particles and light follow paths on curved space-time. And gravitational waves and black holes require no matter, they're pure gravity, so it's very easy. And this is the mathematical version. There's a quantity called the metric that tells you information about distances between points. I know this is very introductory. And then in order to do calculations, we need to take derivatives. This is really a gauge quantity, but to get something more physical, we take derivatives of that and get a curvature tensor. And the curvature tensor is, parts of the curvature tensor are what go into the Einstein field equations and give us a part called the Einstein tensor. And for gravitational waves and matter, the left-hand side of Einstein's equation, which is the stress energy tensor from the matter, is just zero because there is no matter. So it's a really simple set of equations, which will show up in a minute. Just G equals zero. So you say, well, that's pretty easy to solve. And it is, as long as you're comfortable with just getting flat space-time as your solution. But if you want it to be interesting, you have to do some work. So here's just a quick, rough sketch of kind of how this works. We take space-time and go back and cut into slices of space that are stacked together through time. And so, for a simulation, you then put some initial setup on one slice, and you have some equations that tell you how this turns out to be a Cauchy problem, so that if you have one slice set up, you can predict what the next slice will be from Einstein's equations. That's a subset of Einstein's equations. There's additional portion of Einstein's equations. Einstein's got 10 equations here. So there's some for evolving, and the others are constraints. And so your initial data has to satisfy some constraints, and then you evolve consistently, and the constraints will remain satisfied. So at the end of the day, for practical evolutions, we end up with 10 to 20 fields that were sort of evolving related to gravitational information in a set of partial differential equations. So there's a long history to trying to do this, starting back in the 60s. And then there was the first real attempts to do this in 3D kind of in the early 90s, and it was really hard. And then eventually it was suddenly very easy around 2005, and a couple different approaches started just working really well, and a lot of stuff has happened since then. And that's mainly, we've sort of crystallized into two main approaches. So there's most of the groups are working on this sort of moving puncture formulation, and these typically use one particular formulation of the equations, and they use finite difference numerical techniques. They're using, most of these are now using CACTUS, the computational framework. and this, which includes adaptive mesh refinement.
The other approach is this
is uses a different formulation equations, which can work with a spectral formulation of the spatial derivatives for handling the spatial derivatives. And they have, there's just one group really, one multi-institution group at Caltech, Cornell, and CETA that are doing this. They get very active. This approach gives you, you know, very accurate simulations. It's great for the long, long waveform studies. But it's a little more work to do it. So, you know, a larger number of simulations are done here, and these have tended to focus more on what happens in just the final moments, which is really good for understanding things like kicks and what the final spin is and what the basic behavior of black holes is like. This one is this basic stuff, and this one is really focused on getting the really long waveforms themselves.
And they all agree.
They agree, yeah, when tested against each other with appropriate, you know, qualifications for how we expect them to be. There are
subtleties that remain in terms of how you define the radiation once you get down to really fine levels of precision.
But there's a whole lot of questions that are more urgent now than.
There aren't really any great
terrible subtleties. It's pretty. You get pretty consistent results where you need to. The biggest subtleties perhaps are related to the fact that there's still some gauge dependence, and you need to be careful about how you define the radiation. You're trying to extract it sort of far away from the black holes, but how far away is far enough? And so we sort of do extrapolation, trying to make sure that there's no dependence on the extraction radius. But the simulations, anyway, let's avoid these details, because I have a whole lot of slides. You end up with lovely movies like this at the end of the day, actually, if you hire somebody to make a lovely movie or go do some, you know,
work with a visualization
package. So you see black holes merging around each other. There's a structure of gravitational field around them, which is, you know, the metric and all the curvature quantities. And you know, at the end of the day, you end up with some gravitational radiation coming out, and you can quantify what your waveform signal predictions will look like and do all kinds of other interesting stuff. So here's my master
slide on
the kind of stuff that vacuum binary black hole numerical relativity studies are applied to. By the way, I need to have a clock going so I have some idea of how much time I'm taking. There we go. All right. So I've sort of set together a couple categories. A number of different type of phenomena are studied, and I mentioned that the one of the two categories of approaches to the simulations has been used for a lot of this. It's stuff that we've been interested in, just figuring out how much energy comes out, what the final spin of the black hole that's formed from a merger is, looking at how mergers of different mass ratio compare with each other, looking at the effect of spins, the first primary effect being that you get this spin-orbit coupling effect, which can extend the merger for aligned spins. The next effect is precession, which can create some complicated dynamics, which are really interesting, and also lead to structure in the waveforms, which is great for trying to get information out about the system. Probably everybody knows that if there's asymmetry in a system, then more gravitational radiation goes out in one direction and another, and you get a kick, and so there's work on quantifying that. And there's less been done on, you know, what happens if we have an eccentric set of mergers. I should comment, just in terms of what the parameter space of merger simulations is like, generally speaking, if you... Let's see, a white piece of chalk would be good. If you have two black holes, then for each black hole, so here's a black hole, and it's got a mass, and it's got a spin vector, which is 3 degrees of freedom, and it's got a momentum vector, which is 3 degrees of freedom, and it's got a position. So that's 10 parameters to describe one black hole. And if I have two, then I have 20 parameters. So. But three of those we can't measure with the gravitational wave observation, and we always sort of forget about. Those are a source of the center of mass momentum. You can't measure. The line of sight motion, has an impact on the signal, but it's entirely degenerate with the redshift. So we can't measure it separately. And then the motion across the sky is too tiny to ever have any observable impact. So the rest of them, 17 parameters, are the ones that we have to fit if we're really doing a gravitational wave on space. But when you're doing a simulation, it's really just, we don't care about the position and orientation of the system and all of that. So at the end of the day, there's only 9 of the parameters. Also, the mass we get a free mass for our simulations because we can just rescale time and space with the mass. And so at the end of the day, then there are 9 parameters for simulation. And 2 of those I'll mention are eccentricity and are usually, we assume we start with low eccentricity, though we now have some general understanding that it's possible that there would be detectable levels of eccentricity at the point of getting gravitational waves. So, just a little aside. So, on this part of the phenomenology, I mentioned that we have taken an interest in what happens when you have different masses of mergers. These are all non-spinning mergers. Generally speaking, the end of the merger, once you get to the ISCO, there's a great deal of general similarity about in spirals up to the point of ISCO, and you get a kind of decent picture of what the waveforms are like up to that point from the post-Newtonian models, which are the analytic models for these. It's not exactly correct in the last few orbits, but it gives you the right idea. But then at merger, the post-Newtonian models don't have anything to tell you anymore. If the mass ratio is small enough, or large enough, depending on which way you like to look at it, then the signal is small after merger. But for anything in the order of 10 to 1, there's still quite a lot of power in the merger, and it's very, very merger dominated.
Why are the lengths scales different from the different
gravity scales? The
length of these signals?
Yeah. Because people have simulated for a longer time with the Q equal 1 equal mass simulation than they have with it's just you arbitrarily choose when you start the simulation. Essentially, you start with some separation, so the starting point is kind of meaningless. But that's it's a subtlety when you want to actually compare things, because you've got this sort of everything depends on your meaningless starting point when you actually want to compare to it.
There are extremes of this, like this 100-to-1 mass ratio, which has been tackled numerically as well. So you can go out of the box a little, but you have to do brute force effort. So here's a very old slide on the effect of aligned spins in a merger. So if you have spins that are aligned, then there's some extra angular momentum, and you have to kind of get rid of some of that angular momentum. So the sort of qualitative picture, you have to get rid of that angular momentum before you merge. If you you have to do a little bit of that just so you don't end up with a naked singularity at the end of the day. You only squeeze so much angular momentum into the final black hole. So you can also just understand this as just a natural way that spins and orbit angular momentum couple in the energetics of gravity. But so the effect is that you get sort of more slowly developing but still strong signals from aligned spins, positively aligned spins, and that gives you the brightest, the most energy comes out of those simulations, and then you end up with kind of a lot of cycles through the merger. And the opposite is when you have the two spins aligned with each other but anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, and then you have a sort of abrupt merger with few cycles in it. If the spins are not exactly aligned or anti-aligned, then they can process. And so here's an example where you have the two black holes merging together with their spin vectors processing around a little bit, though. In this case, the orbital plane is rigged up with enough symmetry so that the orbital plane is not processing in that case, but that is also a possibility. So, and here's some recent simulations that show some more interesting signals of precession. This is so the angular momentum vector, total angular momentum as a function of time, I think was yellow here,
And these are the individual spin direction vectors. And here's just some trajectories for showing you sort of orbital plane motion. And if you have precession going on, then it leaves an imprint in the waveforms that come out. And those imprints are very rich. And so if all black hole mergers were non-precessing, the waveforms would be more degenerate and it'd be harder to pick out the parameters. So the fact that precession is a phenomenon helps us when we want to go back and figure out what happened. So kicks. And then I've titled this spin kicks. I did that a long time ago when it was part of a set of slides. But we originally looked for, we expected kicks. Kicks come when the gravitational radiation coming out is not going out equally in all directions. So the gravitational wave, you know, roughly speaking, gravitational waves carry momentum. And so if they're not carrying the same amount of momentum in opposite directions, then you end up with a net momentum. Approaching the merger, that's kind of, there's a little bit of thrust that's sort of circling around in which direction it's going. But as you get to the merger, the thrust is growing and then suddenly shuts off. And depending on exactly how that happens, you get a kick. And they can be quite sizable. So actually, we thought they're kind of negligible because they're just like 0.0001 or something, because we use units where C is 1. But they turns out to be kind of large in kilometers per second, say. So. But it turned out that the effects, we could obviously see there's going to be asymmetry when you have unequal masses. That seemed like it should be the big deal. And so the first studies were in that direction, and you see kind of that there was no
kick larger than
200 kilometers per second, no matter how you figure that, if you had optimal sort of mass ratio difference. And so initially it's kind of like, well, this isn't as interesting as we hoped. But then kind of a whole bunch of groups discovered more or less simultaneously that when you put spins in the problem, you actually have potential for much larger asymmetries in the radiation and bigger kicks. And so here's one of the groups that's done the best work on this is the RIT group. And this is a plot including, if it fits for exactly what kind of kicks you get out. I know some people in the room have used these fits in various papers. Now kicks can believe to be possible up to about 5,000 kilometers per second, depending on the configuration. And so, and the maximum kick is with sort of partially, a little bit almost aligned spin directions, but still not too collinear.
So is that a function of Q?
It is a function of Q, and there's a coefficient on the spin kicks that depends on Q. But there's sort of an additive effect, roughly speaking, of the kick you get from the spin asymmetry and the kick that you get from the mass asymmetry, and the mass asymmetry part is not so interesting.
It's the spin asymmetry part.
So what would the same dynamical, say, the same choice of parameters like masses or called spins, the different numerical codes give the same answer?
There have been few real comparative studies there, so it's a good question. It's a little bit challenging. So one thing I should mention, right? So this is this formula is for the maximum kick you get with this. So in the spin parameter space, I meant out of here these 9 parameters. 2 are eccentricity, 1 is mass ratio, and the rest are spin. There's a whole bunch of parameters that go into this, right? And the kick depends on the exact relative orientation of the spins at the time of merger. So there's sort of a couple degrees of freedom where you can really, and that's a sort of mixing process all the way through. So there's really no way to predict exactly how the spins are going to be aligned at the final moments of merger. So there's some really unknown degrees freedom that you just have to say, well, they're random, because it depends on, you know, if you change the initial separation by, you know, a meter or something million years before, it'd be a totally different problem, right? So but you can ask the question, if I then align those spins so at the point of merger, in those random degrees of freedom in a sort of optimal way, what's the maximum kick I could get? And then you just sort of get a sinusoidal cycle depending on what the orientation is that's sort of randomized. It makes it hard to do a real comparative simulation because there's these really fine details that depend, but basically you have to do a whole set of simulations where you kind of fit the peak and then you could compare those, but we haven't really done that.
But John, sorry, before you go on.
You can, yeah.
Just because you didn't really talk about the position you had up there, this Lucidol supertext, that's not really necessarily astrophysically unusual configuration anymore, right? As opposed
it's,
to the, I mean, depending on what you want to say about spin alignment prior to merger, but it compares to the 4,000 copies of N20.
It's still a special case. It was a special case before in plane, but it's a coarse. You can kind of see here. This is the, you know, whether you're in plane or not. This is so you went from being this red dashed curve here being the sort of old one where you're in plane to this one where you're at
pi over four. So it's
45 degrees, right? So it's not close to aligned, like you might expect in a wet merger, but and you see there's a precipitous drop, but
it's a possibility.
It's still going to be a special case because there's a number of different directions in which you had to line things up in order to get this. All right, so merger waveforms. So I mentioned through all this that there's structure that gets imprinted in the waveforms, and that's what we're going to look for when we're trying to do gravitational wave observation. And so here's just some examples. This is an equal mass non-spinning, our classic starting place. And then if you change the mass ratio, you have the effect that there are more multipolar components that contribute to the radiation, and so it gives it more structure. If you want, these are different examples of waveforms with the different multipolar components showing you this is the power and the different multipolar components a function of time. So the multipoles become much more important when you're in the merger than they are in the in-spiral. And if you have unequal masses, then you have a rich structure of multipoles in the figure. If you have equal masses and non-spinning, you know, and then you get some situations. If you have spinning, aligned or unaligned, you get different kinds of combinations. So all of this information gets imprinted in the signature of the waveform. So the multipolar components, of course, then if it's not just for the equal mass non-spinning case, really, it's so dominated by the 2-2, it's so symmetric that if you look at it from any direction, and if you're just looking at it with one degree of freedom, it's going to look kind of similar. But when you have sort of competing modes that are kind of different frequencies, you get these more rich structures that you would see in your data in your detector. And then you get different patterns in the phasing when you change the spins. You can also get precession, which I showed you a couple examples before of precessing waveforms, but I didn't mention them. Here's just a recent summary of the Caltech Cornell's waveforms. This is a snapshot of their 170 waveforms that they have. So this is there's a whole lot of work to be done to really cover a parameter space with waveform cases. You can see some of these have some more interesting precession-based features in them that are more complicated, and others are at least at this eye level kind of bland looking. But there's a whole lot of this work going on.
So in order to see that, you need to obviously align this before the final merge to get the alignment.
Optimally aligned before merger.
Fish, 58.
This one, there's probably a considerable precession effect in the orbital plane at approaching the merger, but they're shorter. Yeah. Well, some of them they just made them short, right? That just means they started close.
The altitude goes to zero and then
no, like 67.
Oh, this one right there?
Yes.
Yeah, that one I think that one kind of does an almost inversion of the orbital plane. That's pretty unusual. They I think that's the one they highlighted in their discussion in this paper. But I'm not gonna highlight it. I'm just showing you the picture. There's too much stuff. There's too much to do. If you tried to, you can't numerically simulate every possibility and then do data analysis for searching for gravitational waves. This is years and years of work by the only group that can do really long simulations, really long, really accurate simulations. So there are analytic models, just like there are with the kicks, analytic models trying to fit the structure of the waveforms, including the ring downs and the mergers. And so one of these is an effective one-body waveform family, which agrees with post-Newtonian's design to be post-Newtonian early on, but then approach a ring down at the end with some sum of quasi-normal modes structuring that. And there are also phenomenological models where you add a post-Newtonian waveform with the numerical and get a long one, and then you fit this with some just functional form that resembles these waveforms, and usually in the frequency domain. So this is a result of a recent community-wide study involving lots of people doing lots of numerical simulations and taking some of these models and comparing them and seeing how this is for LIGO, possible LIGO observations, what the level of disagreement with the analytical models you get for the family of particular, for some particular waveforms. So this is still, for LIGO, this kind of stuff is probably useful and you can get a lot of good information out of it. For something where you have really high signal-to-noise ratios, like you can get with LISA, this is going to be really, really a difficult problem to ever have the end.
Yeah, it'll take a long time to have accurate enough models to fit all the waveform possibilities.
So let me just take a second here and mention some frontiers where numerical simulations of black hole mergers are going. I showed you the waveform from the 100-to-1 mass ratio simulation of RIT. But here's the movie they made. Did you guys see the little black hole going around? It's a little tiny dot. And here's another RIT. They really like doing these exotic, fantastic, cool stuff. So this is a separation in a recent paper of Lou Stone's Wilshire of approximately 50 m initial separation. So this goes around a little over two orbits, and you can see there's a zoom in where you see the separator. So it takes a lot of brute force numerical effort to do these because the time scale of the simulation is ultimately tied to the light crossing time of the smallest black hole you have in the problem. Now you use adaptive mesh refinement to try to recover from this as much as you can. But when you have the black hole moving very slowly around through many, 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 many of those light crossing distances, it's a very large numerical problem to handle.
What are we looking at the inset here?
Yeah. I'm sorry. This is a trajectory of it's not really trajectory. It's a separation vector evolving over time, and then this is just a zoom in, right up here, so you can see the three. There's really three tracks that goes around.
A little bit times, yeah.
Okay, so that was a whole bunch of numerical results, and we see about what we can learn about black hole mergers and what goes into signals. And then I mentioned we have the bigger question of what can we learn about broad or astrophysical processes, and we don't know as much about this. We haven't thought about it as much. And here is a
beautiful plot,
which I think is Alberto's with some very lovely, a team of graphics professionals. So this is for ELISA, and these contours here show. So this is on this axis is the
mass.
This is equal mass non-spinning mergers. This is the mass of the system, or maybe that was the black holes, and this is the redshift. And then this is the SNR by which you would detect them with ELISA. So if they're the right mass in a redshift of 2, it could be an SNR of 1,000. More likely, their smaller mass and redshift of 5 or something. Of course, we don't really know, as Rich was pointing out. If yesterday's morning coffee was talk of 3 gigayears to
get through the final parsec or whatever.
If it really takes that long, then we can't really equivocate between this. Yes.
These noise are taken from some models that I developed.
Yeah.
And these time scales
ice. So it starts from when the two cables see each other, and then waves in the interfacing and scale from the so that's it.
Thank you. And I didn't mean to belittle. Yeah, I didn't say what the tracks are yet. But
if you look at these time scales, they include the delay.
But we don't know for sure how much delay there is, right?
It's not so, the part of it.
So I don't. So I would love to have more detailed conversations about exactly how that works. Cause, you know, there's a lot. I think I have the general impression there's a lot we still don't understand about how black holes are formed, how long it takes them to really merge, and what's out there. And we don't have a very rich set of models that we usually go to when we're doing these kind of studies of what we might learn with LIGHT or something. Yeah.
So what is included in those simulations for sure in a proper way?
Do why don't you say what the tracks are since we're talking about them now?
The tracks are basically mass pressure evolution of the central black hole of selected yellows, basically. So you start with a seed from the top left.
So here's you start with a large seed and you end up with a large black hole at redshift of 6, or you start with a small seed and you end up with a large black hole by redshift of 6.
And all the dots are
mergers, yeah.
And so in doing that, basically, the time of the merger includes for sure reliable estimation of the dynamic operation time, okay, which is giga years at redshift 0, but it scales with 1 - 3/(-3/2). So it's much shorter at that redshift, okay, because the universe is dense.
The hardening
in some models is included through some simple
but you must have made two assumptions. One is how the dark matter halos are seeded to black holes,
sure,
and the relationship of the halo to the black hole.
But
what have you assumed?
That doesn't have anything to do with the
scale.
So
I
pressure depends on the relative total mass of
the system.
I'm glad to stimulate this discussion, but this is only one of my slides. And I think we should have a splinter session on this topic. I was hoping to stimulate that. Okay. So. All right. So go ahead. I'll put up another slide. We can start arguing about.
Illustration that equals not just the gravitational field, matter.
Sorry? This is.
Yes.
That's coming up ahead here. So let me now. We'll throw this into the same splinter session where we talk about what we can actually learn from gravitational wave observations. So these are comparing the few sets of possible population models and what type of measurements you can make about them. So now I want to move on to part two here, which is electromagnetic signals from black hole mergers. Let's see if I have any time left. Okay. Some rough thinking on this. So here's a you have this giant amount of energy coming out in the form of gravitational waves. So we imagine that there's some process whereby, you know, some of that energy somehow leaks into an electromagnetic signal. So you can kind of make up something. So if you had 2% of you started out with some black hole and 2% of its mass gets converted into gravitational waves, you take a millionth of that and you convert it into electromagnetic signal somehow, then you're still left with 10 to the 52 ergs. So it's for a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole. So it's a lot of energy. But then you have the question of how much time does it take for this energy to get somehow reprocessed into an electromagnetic signal and come out. And so the gravitational wave time scale is very short, but then, you know, it depends on what happens and how you generate an electromagnetic signal to get the real time scale, which is likely to be at least as long and probably
possibly much longer. And so exactly what the result is unclear. Potentially very large, potentially very short-lived, but not clear. So said all that. If you want to be able to observe it, it has to be sufficiently bright, but it also has to be distinct from other electromagnetic signals, right? So it can't just be something, there was a warm glow over there, and it looked like any other warm glow that that might have been happening in a galaxy at any moment. But in terms of questions for simulations, in order to understand this, is there some kind of electromagnetic bomb? And I don't think I invented that description here, but anyways, and is the flash from the bomb somehow distinct than other bombs? Because there's lots of electromagnetic bombs in the sky. So here's my one slide, which is extended one slide on this simulation. So there's a whole bunch of different physics you want to add in order to do these kind of simulations. So gravity you can start with. You can just talk about what are the trajectories of particles, and do the particles slam into each other. And the first simulations there suggested, there might be something interesting happening. And then you can do gravity, which is hydrodynamic fluids, and look what happens to the fluids, and simulations in this regard suggest potential for electromagnetic periodicities in a signal leading up to merger. Or instead of that, you could just have electromagnetic force-free hydrodynamics, force-free magnetohydrodynamics, where you assume that the gas is so tenuous that it doesn't have any hydrodynamic pressure at all. And then you have a Blanford's Nyack-like mechanism that suggests you can have these dual jet pictures and things on the way to merger. Or maybe it's important, probably, most likely, it's important to put those effects together and look at hydrodynamic GRMHD, where you have gravity, magnetism, electromagnetism, and hydrodynamics all together. And first simulations here, indicate the effect that you can get a strengthening of the magnetic field through the hydrodynamic flows in the strong gravity dynamics leading up to merger. And since a lot of electromagnetic emission mechanism proportional to magnetic field squared, that leads you to stronger signals. But to really understand these, you really have to look at the radiation coming out, and you have to look at how the radiation is processed and how it's related to the signal. So there's been kind of little nothing done on this. So this is another GRMHD simulation that's been done, and it doesn't really include radiation, but does include at least effective cooling from the radiation, and shows, not surprisingly, that the cooling is important in the dynamics of the circumbinary disk in the vicinity time of merger. Jeremy Schnittman has taken one of our simulations of this and done a course. He has a code for started out for just doing accretion disk emission studies, and without really taking into account the fact that we had two black holes, space time, he can run the code where we just sort of superpose the fluids on his space time structure of a Kerr black hole. But it's enough to kind of see the potential process that you get synchrotron emissions coming out that get, where then seeming to be the potentially inverse content scattered up to a broadband signal there peaking in X-ray. So just having the potential that there's a mechanism for giving X-rays, I think, is interesting, because those would be easier to distinguish from other stuff in the sky. And so another issue that I didn't mention here yet is that, in order to do this, it depends a lot on the details. And one of the important details is what you start with at the beginning of the simulation. You can only do a short simulation if you put in all this physics. And so there you really want to evolve a circumbinary disk for a longer period of time. And there's a GRMHD circumbinary disk simulations that Scott's been doing. And this is really not the right place to stick them in here, because they're also looking at signals that come out in the precursory parts, there's a whole lot to be done there. So that was a very quick whirl through of that, and now I'm probably running out of time. Oh no, I'm doing okay. Okay, so so let's just put.
Maybe I should slow down and let other people digest and see if they had any questions. Did anybody have any questions? I could go. I blew over like a whole bunch of people in the room's work over. Yeah?
So, what do you think?
Well, the mechanism for coupling formulating a GRMHD problem is pretty clear. And, you know, we can do that. There's a couple of groups that have done that now for this problem. But that's not enough to really say something terribly interesting, because I think you really do need to know. It's likely that the real problem is optically thick. And if it's optically thick, then certainly we're not necessarily very close yet without really taking radiation transport into serious account. Then we're probably a few years away from really being able to do that. But
a slightly more general question. Since the energy input is a very short effective time scale, do you have any idea of sort of what the reprocessing time or reverberation times are? Do they broaden things out by factors of 2 or factors of 1,000?
Some
range.
You mean burst?
Yeah.
Is it the burst?
Yeah, in other words, we're convolving something with something else. But if it still keeps the short character that allows you to recognize
the transmission of the gravitational wave burst through this has an angle of people with disability effects.
Yeah.
That
type of the
because there's very poor coupling, and these are very long wavelength modes, so it's like a surfer riding on anti-Noah waves.
Right. So it's not really. Maybe I misled you a little bit. That.
There's a significant mass loss effect. Okay? As you said, that there's a few percent to 10% of mass loss in the system, and then the gas will respond to that. Because that mass loss effect...
Yeah, I probably should have included a slide that I threw out here. That there are a number of mechanisms, so we're sort of looking at this instantaneous mechanism for generating a signal in the direct vicinity of the merging black holes in fluids there. But the effects of the merger on the disk environment, because it suddenly changes, that can give you signals that may persist over a longer period of time.
And the 10 to the minus 6 scaling comes from
I thought a millionth sounded
plausible. The number would be people believe that some gamma ray bursts or neutron star mergers or neutron star black hole mergers, and those indeed have 10 to the minus 10 to 52 Earths isotropic corrected.
The thing with a neutron star merger, you have a ready source of dense matter that you can draw in for electromagnetic signal. We don't really know if for what we have here. I do have this slide now, appropriately, which is designed to stimulate this kind of discussion. So, I just made up, you know, an hour ago, some scenarios here that you might want to think about here. So you could have possibilities where there's little or no gas. Of course, the trivial one is there's no gas whatsoever, and there is no electromagnetic signal. That's very clear, right? Or you could have some very tenuous gas, and there might be a weak signal. You know, this would be purely optically thin. The signal would necessarily be short-lived. You would probably get some kind of broadband spectrum. It'd be a very, you know, I don't know what you get out of that spectrum. Or you could have, you know, the other extreme, a really dense, you know, strongly optical thick cloud of gas around, and all you get out is some kind of thermal, heavily reprocessed, slowly decaying signal over a longer time scale, and it doesn't really distinguish itself from any other infrared signal in the galaxy that you're looking at. It looks just like some kind of star forming region, or not even this, you know, like a pile of stars, whatever. And That would be, you know, there's an intermediate region that's probably the sweet spot where you hope to get some interesting signals from. So, on the other hand, you can consider how are you going to try to observe these. And the first question is, if this is a multi-messenger situation and you have a gravitational wave observation, you might have some information about where it is in the sky. Rough information, maybe. You might have that information in advance, or you might be looking for these in your archival data because that's the only kind of data you have, maybe, whatever it is, and you're trying to do these without the benefit of gravitational waves. Yeah. You look like you're going to say something. No, okay.
I have a simple question. So yeah. When the red ray occurs and those castles are there, what is happening to it? So we're talking about compressing the gas, shrinking the gas, as simple as this, or what?
I think the big question is what happens with the magnetic field. You might disagree, but there are shocks that you get from changing the mass and things like that. There are shocks that you get from the motion approaching the merger, and maybe we get some precursory signals related to something like this.
Actually, most of the light that we see from our solar is due to shocks that pile up from the binary quirk that's sent into this orbiting bump that runs into this.
Orbiting what?
Orbiting about overdensity of gas.
This is far from the
ears. No, this is so our disks follow the binary, so there's enough stress that it's going to follow the binary is down to the end. Yeah, like down to.
So the we've done simulations where we're not seeing shocking effects so much as just. A strong strengthening of the magnetic field at the last moments of merger. Increasing all the magnetically derived like synchrotron.
The shocking might depend also on how eccentric is the orbit.
Eccentricity is likely
to be important in those pre-mergers.
If it's large enough, though.
Because by this time,
that's close to colossus.
No, I know, but I think even the tiny beam might be.
But the tiny beam that we are talking about is like 10^-2
colossus is plus physical force. In some of the risk situations, I see eccentricity growth.
Yeah.
Well, for example, we're
circumventing this.
But our shrinking binary simulation actually the inner edge of the disk colors down to power separation. So there can be some cases, some magnetic field amplitudes that can be a significant amount of magnetic stuff. So then you can have a gap that follows up and down to the power separation.
So I propose another splinter group for this topic, and I'm particularly interested to have discussion of this observational side of the question. So I just threw up some scenarios over there where you might think about sort of
infrared
optical sort of signals, or you might think about X-rays. Personally, those sound more promising, just because I'm really scared about the idea of having to actually distinguish the signal from something else, and that seems like it's less to compete with in the X-ray world if you actually have something there. But then you have problems of we're trying to look at deep extragalactic stuff. We may not have very many photons to pick from, so there's a lot of challenges if you're really going to try to observe these things. Room for good ideas. So now to the final slide. Same slide I had before, so they grayed out some of the things which I have given you information about. It's not very much. There's still a lot today that we don't know about. So I think this leaves us with what are the sort of current big questions in this general area. And these are, you know, for me, some of these questions are really current and important, because the next couple of years through the gravitational waves is when Europe is going to be making its decision as to what it wants to do, in the 2020 to 2030 decade. And so we really would benefit from having a clear understanding of what the relation to gravitational waves and overall astronomy, gravitational observation and overall astronomy, really is. And so I think that's the big question, and stuff that contributes to that is important. So leave it there. Discussion. So,
like running simulations over a large parameter space.
You said there is no chance we can run
if it's nine-dimensional parameter space.
So, okay, fair enough. So, is there some sort of agreement of where the groups are going to constitute the effort?
So there is a team. There's a
worldwide effort.
And a paper that's just been posted to Archive. Sure. There were a lot of people got together, tried to divide up doing simulations, and are using this in order to better generate empirical models for the waveforms, because
that's the
main strategy, right, is to try to generate empirical models that are good enough for doing your observation. Now, you might consider the possibility that if you actually have a specific observation, and you're not confident that your empirical model is perfect enough to get you every last bit, you know, maybe you have high SNR, maybe you think you measured the mass to, you know, within 0.1%, and you want to make sure that you didn't fool yourself, and it's not, you know, not really 4.25, not 4.26 times 10 to the 6 solar masses or whatever, then maybe there would be a reason for taking that specific case and then doing a targeted set of numerical simulations in order to make sure you really understand that little bit of the parameter space well. And then you could tune the models to make sure they're accurate there. But that would be the kind of approach I imagine you take, rather than hoping that you have the parameter, you know, an accurate understanding of the entire parameter space in the finest degree.
So
people are trying to... People have simulation.
It varies, you know, broadly, but there are large simulations. You know, let's say the, you know, 100,000 to 1,000,000 CPU hours. It really depends. Yeah. Could be less, but could be more. It's probably not. It turns out to be a really hands-on problem. The Caltech Cornell people, they have to do a lot of work, as I understand, in order to get their simulations to really be ready to go. Anybody, you always have to be sort of monitoring and making sure it's not a black box, press the button and run kind of thing. It's a
why is that?
I don't have a great answer. To some degree, sometimes it is, but the thing is, there can be problems. And problems like your grid structure didn't turn out to be right for the problem, or, you know, your numerical code recently got changed because you work with a community of coders and it find out that it no longer actually works.
Or is it just a very finicky problem?
Huh?
Is it we have bugs that we'll fix over time, or is this a big problem that's very ill-defined?
So there are always frontiers that are challenges still. And I didn't mention, I had a few things mentioned, but, you know, most, all but like three simulations were with spins less than 0.935, where we have to go to a different family of initial data models, for example, to get beyond that. Or, you know, if you want to do these really long-lasting simulations, then you know, you've got different challenges, and every time you do something that has a little different structure, you know, running longer, having higher spins, more rapidly spinning black holes are smaller, and so you want to, you know, structure your grids or your co-location points in the spectral case a little differently. Everything is kind of unique, and so we make one simulation off of a model or something similar, but we don't have, you know, totally generic approaches to this. I'm kind of surprised that it still seems to be as time consuming as it is, but so some people do better than I do, but
I usually run on
a few hundred processors. People have done
like examples where they run
on a few thousand and show good scaling, but I think there they've turned off everything
interesting about the simulation.
So if you're doing something like it. So people, I know people have talked about doing some sort of brute force set of simulations, but realistically, I don't think we need quite that kind of thing right now. But
what?
For example, for a given mass ratio, we can actually support several spin.
I mean, I think you want to have a lot of simulations.
I think we could use
maybe we do need we do need more of that. Well, we need to get a rich enough sampling of parameter space, so that we can tune these UOB or other models. And that's the effort that the NRAR group is trying to orchestrate.
So this is to follow that up. How does error in the template, not error in the knowledge of the template, change the quoted signals to noise that has been used? I'm making the assumption that the simulations set perfect knowledge of the template. But that's not true, as you just told us.
Right.
So as you have ignorance, some level of ignorance, how does it change the effective signal to noise?
So the effective signal to noise hopefully doesn't change very much. You know, there's a figure of merit, say, for the ground-based stuff, that they'd like to have 97%.
All the signal to noise ratio comes from the inspired, the model at 220 meter level. Okay.
So even so, and that we control it. Huh?
What do you mean control?
Meaning that these are filler expansion in the OC that are now known to the, you know, seventh power.
So some of this, it depends on the mass of the system.
So the signal to noise is dominated by the integration on long time scales where the strong GR effect is not dominant.
Depends on the mass.
But yeah, broadly, okay.
That's true for the neutron star mergers. For sure, which is what the main source for LIGO. It's also true for, you know, sort of conventional, you know, 5 solar mass black holes. Anything in that 10 solar mass range, the merger is happening a little too high for the sensitivity band.
There is
months of the spiral before you have
the frequency domain and set of merger.
So all the signal to noise ratio is coming, yeah? Unless you find
down here more.
Masses, to the
that one?
From
the little cuts.
But
yeah,
you didn't say
yeah,
that,
yeah.
You're saying
spiral. Did I pass it? No. So.
If it's sufficiently the most low level of V over
yeah.
Two,
I saw it.
Exactly.
So, of course, if you have 10 to the 7 solar mass black hole at redshift several, and therefore you just see the very final few orbits, then of course you rely entirely on the merger relativity simulation. However, what saves you there is that you do not integrate for as many wave cycles. Yeah? Okay, you want to make an error which is smaller than half a wave cycle, and therefore there is a trade-off.
I think for
detection, we are in pretty good shape. For very exquisite parameter estimation is a completely different story. And, you know, yeah, we may be biased by systematic numerical errors or other things.
Yeah, people even talk about, you know, are we biased by assuming that GR is right, and there could be another theory that's, but if you're worried about model dependence in a third significant digit of the mass of the black hole, you know, then that's
one significant digit.
Yeah.
It's
okay. People want to do long numerical template contract because they want to waste your, because they want to match the numerical solution to the cosmic expansion in the regime of the cosmic expansion.
So for
there, the match is good. So there is a 1% offset or something.
Yeah.
And since then you solve the numerical constant equation with some energy conservation constraint, I don't see why it's another position to form. So you might get the 1% wrong SNR because you know, by matching the principal signal, but it's you're not screwing up 50% of the signal.
Right. Well, so usually you don't care about if you lost 1% of your SNR, but if your SNR is marked in the ground, this is really important, right? Because if you lose even a few percent, then you potentially lose a number of your significant first objects to observe. So you don't want that to happen. But and for the ground-based cases, the majority of sources you expect are like this bottom one, where the merger happens, like Alberto was talking about, where the merger is not near the sensitive part of the band. So if the merger is not near the sensitive part of the band, the numerical relativity part is not as crucial. But for ground-based, it means if you have black hole mergers with 50 solar mass black holes, sort of intermediate scale, then you'd be really worried about the numerical relativity. But we're not as worried about observing those either. So.
The problem there is that you integrate for many thousands of cycles in the spiral. And then, of course, your wavelength is very sensitive to the post-Newtonian order that you're using your expansion. So you might not have the analytical the correct angle. I mean, if you
don't get too close to the merger, the post-Newtonians should agree with each other.
Right, 3 pm and 2.5 pm. The fitting for one cycle into within thousands of cycles is pretty easy.
I have a general question. So when you talk to middle schools and places like that, when we have a good analogy where we are as far as science is concerned, so what was the other area of physics?
So maybe chemistry a century ago, 50 years ago, some basic understanding, but
I don't ever give such an analogy, so when I talk to kids, they just want to hear about black holes, you know. They love
it. Well, so let's move it to high school, but the analogy that would work with us, where are we? I mean, what is this?
Who is we? Right? So we're in different places for sure. I, as a gravitational wave observer, have never seen data. But other fields, you know, have a different situation.
So that's one unique. I don't know.
Well, I'm not in the LSC, so I've never seen data.
So fake data.
Yeah, I've seen fake data, right? But so, I mean, I think... You can make an analogy between gravitational waves and sort of infantile fields of astronomy in other ways. And I think that, like for now, I think one, if you imagine the first sort of instruments we have, we're not going to know where the sources are coming from in the sky, really. They're kind of like we're just getting some signal, and we'll have a hard time getting information about it. But some of them we have good signal-to-noise ratio. It's a very unusual situation that we have very precise theory about what we're expecting. It's hard to think of anything like that. Maybe it's like the particle accelerator people in that regard. But
it's like the microwave background the year before COVID.
That could be. They had data. They had data, though. But I mean,
no, wait a second. No, there was no detection of microwaves before COVID.
There was detection
of the background.
The flux
was
out.
And we had Maxwell's equations that we knew worked.
Well, we know Einstein's equations worked. I mean,
we don't know that.
Mike, didn't go
we do know Einstein's equations. Actually,
we have observational basis
for some of the gravitational waves.
But
we don't
have. Also, I want to leave this room when I will see my family and my daughter Sarah. Doing all day long and
so if we are the people who are to fund this activity,
okay, so
years, I mean,
please, you sound like a congressman.
that's a good question. So I mean, so no, this is a gravitational waves.
It's we know that the universe is you know dominated by gravitational forces on large scales, and we know there are a few hints of mysteries there. We think we have reason to explain exactly what happens when black holes merge. We think these mergers are happening. We have a totally different way to try to observe them and get totally different kinds of information from that. We're trying to build telescopes that can do that, though unfortunately they're not cheap. So we'd like to really get this entirely orthogonal view on what's going on in the universe. It's very, very quantitative and very detailed, but and potentially shows us things that we can't see any other way. So that's where we are, trying to open the quote new window on the universe.
What for, Joel?
All right, so we're over time. We can keep discussing, but if people want to wander off, they should feel like.